Since the rise of cinema, Bible stories have consistently made their way into the silver screen, Moses and the Exodus story being no exception. But is this ancient story meant to serve a more significant role than merely providing a few hours of cinematic entertainment? In this series that will focus on the first 15 chapters of Exodus, we will address that question and reveal how God's rescue of the Hebrew people by way of Moses serves to paint a picture of the freedom he offers all people today, by way of the better Moses, Jesus Christ.
Well, good morning, Westside. It is good to see you as well. My name is Norm, one of the pastors here. I want to welcome you out on this Sunday. If you have a Bible, join me in looking at the book of Exodus, Exodus chapter 3, second book of the Bible, second book that you'll find in what is called the Old Testament. We are looking at verses 11, chapter 3, verse 11, to chapter 4, verse 17. So as you find that text, just one other announcement for you, a reminder more than anything, and that is the how-to class. We have a how to read and apply the Bible. That is starting not this week, but next week. But we'd like you to sign up online. So go on the website. You can sign up there. It gives us a sense of how many people will be coming and books and all of that stuff. That class essentially seeks to answer two questions: how the Bible and why the Bible, or flip it upside down, why the Bible? Why do we teach the Bible here? And how the Bible, meaning how do we apply it to our lives? And so we want to help you in that. And so if you're a person that's going, I'm not sure about the Bible, I'm not sure if I should give myself to the study of it, we'll address some of those questions that you may have. If you're at a place of convinced, you're convinced, but you just don't know how to apply it, that's for you too. But we'll double back on one another, and so you need to be there for all 6 weeks. It's Thursday nights. It's not successive. It's almost successive weeks, but there's one Thursday that's off, but all of those dates are on the website. All right. Exodus chapter 3, starting at verse 11. If you found it, that's fantastic. Let me pray, and then we'll start walking through a larger hunk of text, but it's a good one, so let's pray. Father, I thank you, as I always do every week, for the allowance of this gathering. I thank you for this place. I thank you for the gathering of God's people under your word today. And I pray, with all of my heart, I pray that you, by way of your Spirit, through your word, would be present with us in ways that are palpable, in ways that we expect, and in ways where we obey. Obey in those things that you're calling us from and calling us to, so that you would be worshiped with our lives and that we would be strengthened and journeyed along in that continuum of faith of Christ-likeness from one degree to the next. So I pray that that would take place. And I pray, as I always do as well, that you would help me as I teach this text, help all of us as listeners. I pray that we would have ears to hear what your Spirit is saying to Westside today. For again, one more time, the glory of your name and our strength. And I pray for these things in the great name of Jesus. Amen. So if you are joining us today for the first time, or perhaps it's been a long time, we are in the midst of a 12-week series on the first 15 chapters of the book of Exodus. We are in week 3 today. What we've looked at thus far, just in the first 2 weeks, is we've seen, and this is where we left off last week, the call of God on Moses. If you were here last week, you may remember that God, who saw the plight and heard the cries of his people, the Israelites in Egypt, the God who remembered his promises to them, recruited Moses to go to the people of Israel, specifically as we see at the last verse that we looked at last week, verse 10, to go to Pharaoh and ask that Pharaoh set the Israelites free. That was the call of Moses last week, called by God, who remembered his promises and resourced and recruited. That was last week. As we left last week, we considered the application for us. An application that begins by recognizing that we too are called, first of all, called from death to life. I talked about that at the beginning of our time last week. We have two certain calls as Christ followers. The first is a call from death to life, a call from sinner to forgiven, a call from slavery to freedom. We all have that call. We're called by God. We're called out of the grave, as it were. But in addition to that call, we are also called to ministry. We are called into the kingdom and we're called to kingdom service. And it's under this second call that we can hear, receive specific calls from God. Calls to walk across the room, calls to move to the other side of the planet, or somewhere in between. We receive these calls. The specific call of Moses from God was, one more time, to go to Pharaoh and ask that Pharaoh let the Israelites out of slavery to him and to Egypt, this great tyranny and affliction and enslavement. So that was a takeaway for us. We have been called, just like Moses was called, to go to a people enslaved, spiritually speaking. People in our world today that cry out for freedom. We've been called to this. Every single one of us who calls themselves a Christ one, we are called to bear witness of the freedom that comes in Jesus. A going that has as its impulse, its impetus, its motivation, the fact that God came to us in flesh, calling himself Jesus to rescue us from spiritual affliction and slavery. So that was what we walked through last week. It's great stuff, right? It's great stuff just when you consider the call of God on us. Just think about that. God calls us. Creator God calls us like he called Moses. He calls us to partner with him. I mean, just again, think about that. It's wondrous that the God of all creation calls us specifically to specific instances of ministry. I mean, what a truth. What a truth. If you just ponder that. That is true of us as it was of Moses. But what also is true of us as we pick up the Exodus event in chapter 3, verse 11 is we often respond to God's call on us like Moses responded to God's call on him. So we receive God's call like Moses received, but we often respond to God's call like Moses responded. As I said, we're looking at a larger body of text today, but I'm going to parcel it down into five sections just to help us. And it's a really obvious outline. So if you were teaching this text, you'd probably do something very similar. It's a text that I'm going to whittle down into five sections that all hang on, trellised on, five questions of Moses. So Moses gets a call. We're going to see five questions from Moses back to God. The first question is seen in verse 11. So just put your eyes and look at chapter 3, verse 11. Let me just double back and remind you specifically of verse 10. God saying to Moses, come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? Question number one, who am I? Who am I to do something like this? Who am I to do that? The first thing that I want you to notice about the question of Moses, personally speaking, as I look at it, I have no issue with it. I really don't have an issue with the question that he poses here. I have no problem with it. It's certainly much better than a response like, well, it's about time. You know what I mean? Well, who else would you ask? I mean, who better to ask? I mean, I'm the man. What have you been doing? There's been a lot of affliction. I've been here. I tried to do something 40 years ago, right? You never showed up there. But Moses doesn't do that. He asks this first question, who am I? To do something like that. I mean, that's a big ask. Double down with the fact that in Numbers chapter 12, verse 3, Moses is described as the most humble or meek man on planet Earth. So when you double down his humility with the task at hand and who he was, question makes sense to some degree. I mean, just consider who Moses is in verse 11 of chapter 3. He's an 80-year-old shepherd living in the wilderness on the run from Pharaoh. That's who he is here. I know we have this big impression of Moses, but as we drop in, He's an 80-year-old guy tending sheep on the lamb, running from Pharaoh. And for all we know, he still has a bounty on his head for the murder of the Egyptian. That's Moses. That's who we get right here. At this stage of his life, he's just an ordinary guy with a rap sheet. Nothing more. Who tended sheep for a living. And so for those reasons, I like the question. It's certainly not surprising when you consider what Moses was being called to. What was surprising was God's reply to Moses in verse 12. Just note it. God said, "But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain." Why is this so surprising? I said, it's not surprising, the question Moses posed. Why is this surprising? Well, it's surprising because there's absolutely no flattery in it. It's not surprising that God doesn't flatter. I'm not saying that. It's surprising in light of our culture. We live in a culture of flattery. In other words, what I'm trying to highlight for us is I want you to note the response of God to Moses because I think it should guide us in how we speak into other people's lives. God does not flatter Moses. God doesn't go, "Oh, Moses, you're fabulous, man. Come on, Moses. Turn the frown upside down, gifted guy, great hair, seen the movies, always great hair, great beard, very strong and robust." Doesn't do that. Doesn't do that at all. We're going to see what he does in just a second, but I want to read a longer quote coming from Neville Callum. Neville Callum was a former pastor. He's now the general secretary of the Baptist World Alliance. Commenting on our culture of flattery, he writes the following. "Isn't it bewildering to hear people offer praise where, were they honest, they would express disgust? Some people believe they ought to flatter their listeners excessively in order to curry their favor. The culture of extravagant flattery poses several dangers. First, it tends to have a corrosive effect on those who are steeped in the practice. Flattery finds its origin and support in a spirit of insincerity. Those who practice it often may eventually lose the capacity to bear accurate witness to what they believe. They become so skilled at disguising their true opinion through deliberate and practiced manipulation of words to serve dubious ends that they become numb to the morality of the means they employ. Second, flattery has negative effects on those whom the flatterer has to relate. People come to associate the flatterer with overstatement, and they may lose confidence in the reliability of the flatterer's judgment. Over time, whatever the flatterer says is taken with a grain of salt as the untrustworthiness of the person adept at flattery becomes well known. The reason is because at its base, false praise is a form of deception. What is surprising is the extent to which persons appear to desire or to enjoy being flattered. They thrive on it, even though one supposes they know the aim of the flatterer. It is to win their favor, whether using fair means or foul. Could it be that they are so desperate to believe the narrative they developed about themselves that when flattered, they find confirmation of what they already think of themselves? Could it be that the need for affirmation drives some persons to cherish flattery? What is at stake in the culture of flattery is not simply Christians' readiness to follow certain rules or laws. What is at stake is the kind of person the Christian is. Those who have mastered the art of flattery need to ponder what story flattery tells about the character of the flatterer. What kind of person is it that indulges in excessive flattery? No one has to fall in line with the culture of flattery, and while one may have to pay the price, The rejection of that vain culture says something about one's integrity as a Christian. Speaking the truth lovingly may prove to be costly, yet it's worth it. Our faithfulness to Christ is at stake in the words we speak. Instead of flattery, God responds to Moses' question with two promises. You can see them in verse 12. The first is a promise of his presence. He says to Moses, I will be with you. Who am I? I'll be with you. And with this promise, we are reminded, and it's really important as we walk through the story of Exodus, that Moses isn't the hero of the story. He's not. Don't tell your kids to grow up to be like Moses. He's not the hero of the story. The hero of the story is God. God is the hero of the story. God is saying to Moses, I know your past, Moses. And I know your present situation. And I know your resume. But I'm going with you. I will be with you. That's the first promise. The second is a promise of success. Again, you can see this in verse 12 where God says to Moses, when you come out, when I bring out the Israelites from Egypt, you will serve me on this mountain. Just note that word, serve. Important word. It's a word that speaks of worship. In fact, in your Bible, some of you may have translations that translate it as that, worship. But it's more than worship in how we think of it. It's a worship that has entirely wrapped up in it a service. That our whole lives are worship, is worship, that we serve God. The reason why this word is tied up in worship, service and worship, is because the Hebrew word for worship is the same word that is used for the expression to be a slave. When you bring them out, you will serve me, you'll worship me, you'll worship me in your service, in the totality of your lives, on this mountain. Speaking of Mount Sinai and the region of Horeb. In fact, quoting this text in Acts chapter 7, Stephen, before he was stoned, states this, and he's referencing, he's quoting our text. And after that, they shall come out and worship me in this place. Now, why am I spending some time talking about this? Well, I want us to see this. This is key for us in 2015. See, understanding this helps us appreciate what God is saying to Moses. See, what God is saying to Moses is, the slavery that I'm going to bring you out of in Egypt, as I bring you out and I bring you to this mountain, is going to be replaced with a slavery to me. A slavery replacing the tyranny of a horrific leader who brings death is going to be replaced with a slavery, a totality of life serving me, a good master, one who is not bringing death but life. In other words, what God is saying to Moses and what we've talked about a little bit over the last couple of weeks is that God is saying to Moses, I'm not bringing freedom to the Israelites just for freedom's sake, but for worship's sake. Not just freedom into a vacuum, but freedom to worship me in everything, with all of you, all of who you are. That's what you're being called to. And Westside, so to us. That's the Christian life today for us. That's why Paul begins the second part of the book of Romans, therefore, by the mercies of God, and I've added these next few words, mercies past, mercies present, mercies future, right? Therefore, first 11 chapters of the book of Romans, you were enslaved. You were enemies of God, but because of the mercies of God, mercies past, present your bodies, mercies present, because why do we have a volition to express worship to God now? Because of God's mercy and mercy's future. Present your bodies as living sacrifices, which is your spiritual worship. Lay down your lives. That's worship. It's more than singing, although it's nothing less than singing either. Singing is key. It's a great gift from God. But it's more. It's the totality of living sacrifices, our whole lives. That's why Paul, in several places, oftentimes refers to him how? in his relationship with Jesus, understanding and bringing all of this together, he introduces himself as a slave of Jesus. A doulos, the Greek word, bondservant, one who has purposely enslaved himself to Jesus, a good master. A good master who has laid his life down for his servants. He's now my Lord. He's my master. All things pale in comparison to my good master, Jesus. I'm a slave of Jesus. I'm a servant of Jesus, and Westside, so too are we. We are not set free just simply for freedom's sake, but for worship's sake. And we get that here. Before moving on to the second question, I need to ask the obvious question coming out of this. Are any of you resisting God's call on your life currently because of your past? Maybe it's the initial call. And because of your past, you're concluding that you're too far gone. I ask the question again, especially in the light of this text, are any of you resisting the call of God on your life currently because of your past? Or perhaps some of you are resisting the call of God on your life because of the quote-unquote ordinary place you are in right now. Ordinary in light of maybe the big call that God has on you, and you're evaluating your life like Moses did. I'm just a shepherd living in the wilderness, and I've got a rap sheet. Who am I? Who am I to do this? God's response to you, I'm not going to flatter you. I know who you are, and I know the task at hand, but I will be with you and lead you to places of worship. But Moses isn't convinced. Sounds good. He's not even close to being done. So he's got a second question, and the second question is found in verse 13. Let me read verse 13. Then Moses said to God, If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? Just stop there. Second question. Second question, in many ways, relates to the first. It's sort of the flip side of it. First question was, who am I? The second question, who are you? Who are you? What stands out about verse 13 is the uncertainty about Moses going, right? I try to emphasize that. If I go, all right? I'm going to weigh some things, God. If I go. So there's the uncertainty of his going coupled or contrasted against the certainty of the question that would be posed to him. What is his name? What is his name? As one Hebrew scholar put it, you can read that as, if I go, they will ask. It's a certainty. This question will come up. Now, a couple things to note about the question specifically. First, it's asked because in the culture and the time and the history, your name was directly related to who you were. The kind of person you were, the kind of character you had, the type of attributes that were evidenced in your lives, those types of things. And that was no more true than with God. The name of God describes what God is like. So when they ask, what is his name? We are to read it as, what's he like? What's he like? We can read it as, can he be trusted? The God that sent you to us, can he be trusted? Additionally, the question Moses poses on behalf of the people is more than likely the same question he had. You are sending me. You promised to go with me. But who are you? And one more time, can I trust you? Isn't that a question we ask at least at times, especially in connection with the calls that we receive? God, can I trust you? How would you answer? Now, I know the right answer, The one that we quickly, yes. Yes, he can be trusted. Okay, let me ask it a different way. How would your life answer? How would the choices this week answer? As you process decisions, as you give your lives to the day-to-day, does your life evidence that you trust God? So I ask it one more time. How does your life answer the question, can God be trusted? Who are you, God? Can I trust you, God? God responds in verses 14 and 15, the most discussed written verses, written two verses of verses in the whole book of Exodus. God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Confusing verses on a first read. Let me see if I can help us walk through it. Moses poses the question, who are you? Who should I say sent me? God responds first in verse 14, just note it there, with the phrase I am. In the Hebrew, that phrase I am is Hove, comes up three times. Hove, Hove, tell them Hove sent you. That word Hove is a word that means to be. So he responds that way. Tell them Hove, to be has sent you. But then note in verse 15, God further clarifies, and he says in verse 15, tell them the Lord, the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has sent you. That word there for Lord, just note it. It's a word that in the Hebrew where we get the name of God, Yahweh. We don't really know how to say it. It's actually formed with four letters in the Hebrew, Yod Heh Vav Heh. We say Yahweh. What's important about that name, Lord, there, is it's a play on the word I am, Hove. And what God is saying to us here is, tell them Yahweh has sent you. Today, we don't usually refer to the name Yahweh. We use the more modern form of it, which is the name Jehovah. Jehovah is the Latinized form of Yahweh. It's taking those four letters, Latinizing them, adding a couple of vowels to them. So that's where we get the name Jehovah. But do you notice in your Bibles that the word Lord there is all in capitals? It's all in capitals. Every time you read through your Bible in the Old Testament specifically and you see Lord, capital L-O-R-D, it's the name Yahweh. It's the most oft-used name in the Old Testament. It comes up about 6,800 times in the Old Testament. But here's the question. What does it mean? If that's what it is, what does it mean? Who should I say sent me? What should I tell them? Well, first off, and most importantly, it's a name that speaks of God's self-existence. It's a name that means God is not contingent upon any outside agencies. It's a name that tells us that God isn't to be recognized first by what he does, but by who he is. I am. And therefore, it's a name that speaks of God's immutability. In other words, his unchangingness. God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. God is the first and the last. God is the Alpha and the Omega. But it's also a name that speaks of God's covenant-keeping relationship with his people. Now, why? Why do you couple that first aspect with this second aspect? Well, the reason why is because God is unchanging and doesn't rest on outside agencies, his covenant promises are secure. And therefore, it's a name that calls us to rest in him. We can rest because the covenant-keeping, unchanging, self-existent God is with us. And it assures us that we have no need to look elsewhere. He has and never will fail. And that's why God also says at the end of verse 15 that this is the name that is to be his memorial name forever, as we see it there. See, what God is saying to Moses in verses 14 and 15 is, Moses, tell them that. And Moses, I'm telling you that too. That's who's calling you. That's who's sending you. That's who's going to be with you. See, I love the fact, and just note it, it's a little nugget. Perhaps you picked it up yourself. Moses' first question in verse 11 is, who am I? God's response in verse 14, I am who? Trust me. That's who's with you, Moses. I will never fail you, Moses. Some 1,500 years later, Jesus is having a back and forth with some religious leaders at the time. And in that back and forth, they're calling into question the authority of Jesus and who he was and the claims that he was making. And Jesus specifically says to them, going back, Abraham looked forward to my day and was pleased to see it. Their response is, what? You're not even 50, and you're talking like you're seeing Abraham? How can you say that? You're nuts. Here's Jesus' response. Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am. In the Greek, that's ego eimi. Ego eimi in the Greek is the translation of the Hebrew word hava. Before Abraham was born, hava. Therefore, they picked up stones to throw at him. Why? Because he was claiming to be God. In their minds, committing heresy. In Jesus' mind, speaking the truth. I'm Yahweh God in flesh. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple because it was not time for him to be killed on the cross. God continues in verses 16 to 22. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt, and I promise I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. If you're tea drinkers, you're going to love the promised land. And they will listen to your voice, and you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. And now, please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty. But each woman shall go ask her neighbor and any woman who lives in her house for silver and gold and jewelry and for clothing. You shall put them on your sons and your daughters. So shall you plunder the Egyptians. In other words, I will give you favor with the Egyptians. You go to your next door neighbor and go, nice Camaro. It's all yours. Take it. Take it. Nice brooch. It's all yours. I like your pool. Let me dig it out. I'll put it in your backyard. I like it. You will not go empty-handed. There's a lot in these verses. There is much here that time doesn't allow us to dig deep into. What I want you to notice in these verses more than anything, especially coming out of the name that God just revealed to Moses, is the overarching sovereignty of God revealed here. Just notice what he says one more time. I promise to bring you up, verse 17. The elders will listen to you, verse 18. I promise. In verses 19 and 20, God states to Moses, Pharaoh won't listen to you. He won't. I'm sending you to him. He won't listen. But that will necessitate my working of wonders. And then lastly, as I mentioned, I will give you favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so much so that they won't be able to help giving you much on your way out. They will literally self-plunder themselves. Now, I know in highlighting that I open up the discussion of God's sovereignty versus our will. But before you start going down those roads in your community groups, individually, over coffee with your buddies this week, let's keep the main thing the main thing. And what Moses is hearing from God, God is showing himself as being in control. I'm in control, Moses. I am that I am, Moses. I am self-existent Moses. I am not contingent upon anything, Moses, and I'm sending you. That should be good enough, right? It's a good response. A lot of promises. Moses, not even done yet. Verse 1 of chapter 4. Then Moses answered, but behold, it's the word look. Look, God. They will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, the Lord did not appear to you. What is this third question? What if they say? In other words, okay, let's just say that I agree to go, and they tell me, and I tell them that the I am, Yahweh, has sent me. What if they say, prove it? Why should we believe you? Look at the response of God in verses 2 to 9. The Lord said to Moses, what is that in your hand? Moses said, a staff. And he said, throw it on the ground. So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses ran from it. But the Lord said to Moses, put out your hand and catch it by the tail. So he put out his hand and he caught it, and it became a staff in his hand, that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Again, the Lord said to him, put your hand inside your cloak. And he put his hand inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then God said, put your hand back inside your cloak. So he put his hand back inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. If they will not believe you, God said, or listen to the first sign, they may believe the latter sign. If they will not believe even these two signs or listen to your voice, you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water that you shall take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. Just stop there. This is a great part of the story. If you've grown up in the church, been to Sunday school, this is something that you've probably seen before, walked through it before. What we have here are three signs, all great signs. They stand in and of themselves about the wonder that they provide. But they are also signs that when considered in the light of the culture at the time and the grander story of God, they aren't merely signs. But they serve as revelation and promise. What do I mean? Let me explain this by taking them one at a time. Just note it. I want you to see this. There's something grander at play here than just signs and wonders. Let's look at the first sign. The first sign in it, Moses is instructed to throw down his shepherd's staff and it becomes a serpent. Have you ever considered what kind? What kind of snake? Just note the slide and note Pharaoh's headdress. You see what he has on his headdress? He has a cobra. It's an uprising cobra. The uprising cobra to the Egyptians was really important. It was a sign of rising protection of Pharaoh, the rising protection of Pharaoh. It was an emblem, and I quote, that depicted sovereignty, royalty, and divine authority. Now let me ask, could it have possibly turned into a cobra? I don't know. Consider the culture. I was in Africa last October. Every once in a while I sat under this little swing set, had a cover, a canopy over top, and I would read, like a three-seater canopy, tree over top, just sitting there hanging out. One day all of a sudden I hear rustling in the tree. All of a sudden, something falls on top of the canopy, drops right in front of me. It's a cobra chasing a gecko and snatches it right in front of me. Woo! Exactly. That's when I knew I wasn't called to Africa at all. I ran like Moses, man. Big time. Ran like Moses. Right? And that's what's going. We get a sense here. So what happens? What happens to Moses when he sees this stick, this shepherd's staff turned into this snake, perhaps a cobra? He runs. He runs afraid from the snake. But Westside, can I suggest to you this isn't the first time Moses has run from a snake in the story of Exodus? Go back to chapter 2. Look at verses 14 and 15. This is right after the murder of the Egyptians, where Moses comes back. He answered, this is one of the Israelites, who made you prince and judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid, and he thought, surely the thing is known. When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh. And he stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Can I suggest to you that what's taking place in chapter 4 is a picture of what has already occurred? Moses, you're resisting my call because you're living in fear of Pharaoh the snake. And you need to stop running and trust me instead. How is this trust, this call to trust, of trust to God given to Moses? What is God's instruction? Pick up the snake by the tail. I don't know a lot about snakes, but I know that this is asinine. You don't pick up snakes by the tail. If you can, you kind of get them right behind the head, especially cobras. Pick up the snake by the tail. And what does Moses do? He reaches out. Can I suggest one more time? In faith, trusting God, and that snake becomes a staff again. What is God saying to Moses? Moses, you are so full of fear, but I am in control. I stand over Pharaoh the snake. And you need to trust in me, even if what I'm calling you to do is foolish. That's what's going on here, I believe. Also depicted here is the call to throw down what we now are when God calls us to something else. You're a shepherd now, Moses, but I want you to throw down that and grab hold of this. Throw it down. That life, over. Throw it down. Pick up the new thing that I have for you. And in actuality, Moses doesn't stop being a shepherd. He just shepherds differently now. This does beg questions for us. Many, many questions that you can wrestle with in your community groups this week. But let me ask just some of them. What are you running from right now? You running from any snakes, quote unquote, right now? What is God calling you to throw down? What is he calling you to pick up by the tail, as it were? Is he calling you to something that the world would say is utterly foolish and demands utmost trust in him? Can I encourage you to pick it up? What about the second sign, this hand turning leprous and back again? Well, hands, as I think many of us know, speak of authority in the scriptures. Jesus sits at the right hand of the Father, right? Jesus holds the seven stars in his right hand, those types of things. It speaks of authority, and therefore, this could be referencing the authority of Pharaoh, the authority that God would ravage, but I don't think that's it. I think this is a sign of assurance for Moses specifically. I think this is a reference of Moses' view of himself as being unclean and unusable, and God is showing him his cleansing power and ability to heal the most leprous of lives and use them thereafter. And the third sign, the water from the Nile turning into blood. Well, the Nile, I think, as some of us know, historically speaking, gave the Egyptians much of their confidence and power. The Egyptians regarded the Nile River as the source of life and productivity. So Moses showing the Egyptian people and the Israelites his power by way of God working in and through him over the Nile would prove that God had given Moses the ability to overcome the Egyptians and that he, meaning he, God alone, was the source of life and death. So there's more going on here than simple signs, I believe. Assurance and promise. I think we get a picture of who God is. In fact, Westside, does this not remind you of the gospel of Jesus in these verses? Does this not remind you of Jesus specifically? Jesus who didn't run from the serpent, but ran to the serpent, allowing the serpent to bite him and be lifted on a stick. But by doing so, he crushed the serpent's head. And doesn't it remind you of Jesus who came to cleanse us from our past and make us whole again?
And Jesus, does it not remind you of Jesus who promises a wellspring of life to pour out of us by way of the Spirit? A Jesus who grew up in a kingdom, in a sense, if I can use that language, existed in a kingdom like Moses, but came down to his own. Does this not remind us of Jesus? It's wondrous. This is the gospel. This is the gospel story. This is why people say the Exodus is the Old Testament's gospel. It reminds us of Jesus. He has to be good by now, right? Three questions, three answers, signs, wonders, revelations, promises, not quite. Look at chapter 4, verse 10. But Moses said to the Lord, "Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent. I'm not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue." This is the question that I am posing as, what about this? What about this specific thing that I have to deal with? God, I don't speak good. I need someone who will speak gooder than me. That's kind of what we get here. We don't know exactly what the issue was with Moses. He could have stuttered. Maybe he just got tongue-tied when the pressure came. We don't really know. We're not told. It's not sure. What we again see is God's response, however, to it, verse 11 and 12. Then the Lord said to him, "Who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute? Or deaf? Or seeing? Or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall speak." Still no flattery. God's answer instead, "Thanks for the heads up, Moses. But I'm fully aware of your limitations. I know who you are. I made you, speech impediment and all. I am God, and I'm the one who determines man's and woman's abilities, and I'm calling you, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what to say." This once again displays the sovereign rule of God. And once again, it's hard not to be reminded of Jesus and his words to his disciples before sending them out, saying this in Luke 21, verse 15, "I'll give you a mouth and wisdom, which none of your adversaries will be able to withstand or contradict." After answering all of Moses' objections and promising to be with him in word and mighty deed, God reiterates his call at the beginning of verse 12. You can see it there. "Now therefore go." Now therefore go. Moses' response in verse 13, but he said, "Oh my Lord, please send someone else." Four questions so far. Who am I? Who are you? What if they say, what about this? And finally, a fifth. How about no? How about no? That's what we get here. Get someone else, anyone else, just not me. Please. Please, take no for an answer. Look at verse 14. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. Just stop there. Here's the question that will begin our wrap-up. Why did God get angry? And you need to note that that word kindled, it speaks of burning. It's red hot. Wasn't sort of losing it, in a sense, if I can use that language that we use of our anger. He was red hot, angry at Moses at this point. Why? Is God like a parent who just finally gets exasperated at the questions of their kids? Why, Dad? How, Dad? How come, Dad? Who made you the boss, Dad? Those kinds of questions. And finally, that's enough. I'm done with your questions. Is that it? Go play on the street. Is that it here? Is that it here? Don't do that. Don't do that. That's not why God gets angry here. Because in actuality, Moses doesn't ask a question here. He just says no. No In light of what? In light of God's promises? No, in light of God's provision, and no, in light of God's revelation and empowerment. All things coming from the I Am himself. See, Moses' response in verse 13 wasn't doubt. It was disobedience, wrapped up in a thick layer of faithlessness and distrust. See, Westside, God is long-suffering and will enter our doubts. He will enter our questions with much forbearance, but please understand, he will react with anger to our disobedience too. Burning hot anger. Not because he isn't patient, but because our faithlessness and fear and unbelief is arising in spite of what he has given to us, revealed to us. But as we close, I want you to notice how the text ends. It doesn't end with God's anger. It ends with further grace from him. Look at verse 14. Pick it up after we read that the Lord was kindled against Moses. He said, "Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. Behold, he is coming out to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you both what to do. He shall speak for you to the people, and he shall be your mouth, and you shall be as God to him. And take in your hand this staff with which you shall do the signs." Further resourcing, further promises, further revelation, further partnership. What grace. It's a story at this stage that ends with much grace. So Westside, as we close and we go into a time of response, we receive calls from God like Moses did. And oftentimes, we respond to the calls of God like Moses did too. Sometimes even with no, send someone else, anyone else. A response I would like to suggest as we close our time when a call is evaluated only by who we are and the task at hand instead of reflecting on the I Am who sends. So as we go into this time of response, I want us to go into a time of response reflecting on the I Am and worshiping him because that's what we've been set free to do. And out of that worship and service, may we consider the calls that he has given us. Let's pray together. Father, so that is my prayer, that as we go into this time of response, that by way of your Spirit just working and resting heavy on us, our eyes would be on you, that our hearts would lean towards you with much love and much worship and much adoration, that we would take our eyes off ourselves, we would take our eyes off our situation and reflect on you. And out of that reflection of what you've done for us, what you have led us to, and who you are in our lives. As the great I Am, out of that, we would reflect on the calls that you have on us. And I pray that this would be a great time of ministry as a result, for the glory of your name and our joy. I pray. Amen.